Welcome to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.
Hi there, and welcome to the Currency podcast with Ed Brophy, public policy columnist with Currency. This week, I am speaking to Helen Thompson, professor of political economy at Cambridge University, regular contributor to the Talking Politics podcast, and author of the soon-to-be-published book, Disorder, Hard Times in the 21st Century. Helen, welcome to the Currency podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ed.
Helen, I have a kind of, you know, a list of questions and many questions prompted by your excellent book that has kind of been, I've been reading for a while and have been turning over my head, but I just couldn't, I felt we couldn't, you know, pass the moment without talking about the events overnight in Ukraine and just the wider context of that and how that feeds into the themes in your book, particularly as it relates to issues like Nord Stream 2 and European kind of energy markets and energy security. What is your take on the kind of potential consequences of how things are playing out in Ukraine at the moment?
Well, I think that this Ukraine story is, what's happening in Ukraine, I should say, is has been a long time coming. In the book, I argue that in terms of Europe, that Ukraine is the principal geopolitical fault line of the post-Cold War world. And it brings together questions about the future of the European Union in terms of where Europe is, in some sense, and who the European Union is for, because clearly the majority of Ukrainians would like Ukraine to join the European Union. It brings a big border with it, or has a big border for the with Russia, and I think in some ways the most difficult thing in Ukraine's position from the start of the end of the Cold War, and really from the start of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, is that Ukraine was the principal, the territory of Ukraine when it was part of the Soviet Union was the principal route in which Russian, then Soviet gas exports came into Europe. So when the Soviet Union dissolved and you have a Russian state and you have a Ukrainian state, then Russia, where the oil and gas are, gas being particularly consequential here, has to now manage, from its point of view, the problem of transit of that gas through Ukraine. And there's a whole set of conflicts that ensue from that, directly between Russia and Ukraine, and they have consequences for the European Union, individual European Union countries particular. So all the way through, I think certainly I'd say since the early 2000s, but then there's big wake-up calls in 2009 when there's a particular Russia-Ukraine crisis. There's a desire in significant parts of the European Union to find a way around Europe's dependency, or enough of Europe's dependency on Russian gas. And then there's another view, which is probably more forcefully articulated in Germany, that the issue is really the reliability of transit through Ukraine. And this is where the Nord Stream project comes about, mm-hmm. because the great advantage, obviously, you know, from Russian point of view and from German point of view, is that if you go under the Baltic Sea for the gas pipeline, you take out Ukraine, and from Germany's point of view, that's more politically secure than the structural turbulence, if you like, built into the Russia-Ukraine relationship. That's deeply unpopular for very understandable reasons in Poland, for instance, that regards the Nord Stream pipeline, as the then foreign minister said when it was first announced, as the equivalent of the Nazi-Soviet pact. So these issues have been raising really difficult problems for European Union countries, both collectively and at an individual level, where interests are very different. And as we know, one of the problems now is that it's quite difficult for there to be a common European Union position.
Yes.
And a common NATO position. And if you're, you know, it's very easy to sit and criticise Mario Draghi, who has basically said in the last few days that there shouldn't be sanctions.
Yes.
There shouldn't be energy sanctions on Russia. Mm-hmm. But Italy is very dependent on Russian gas, and it's actually dependent, unlike Germany, on that gas coming through the Ukrainian pipeline. And you can't just suddenly sort of
No.
Change tack and no. say, okay, the gas is coming somewhere else, from somewhere else, particularly when it's the middle of winter.
Yes, yes. So some of the chickens, I suppose, are coming home to roost with the current Ukraine crisis in terms of Europe's energy security and Europe's energy supply and the choices I think European countries have made about their energy supply and their energy security over the years. And I mean, that is a central theme of this order, I think, you know, that energy has largely gone unrecognized as a critical factor in the geopolitical and economic crises of our time. I was very struck by a passage from the book where you write that, quite simply, without taking energy seriously, there is no persuasive story that can be told about the trajectories of economies from the 1970s through to the 1980s or their political consequences. And it just made me wonder, why do you think energy has been kind of, you know, not taken seriously and missing from the kind of the political discourse around these crises? And also kind of linked to that, do you think the transition currently underway, you know, the energy transition underway, will place energy closer to the centre of the political discourse in the future?
If you look at the way in which modern civilization and modern economies have most frequently been and conceptualised, and the people who in some sense gave their lives to thinking about that, including someone like John Maynard Keynes, then energy just didn't really feature in their conceptual vocabulary. And I think that that speaks to a deeper issue, which is that it's been more common to think about modern economies and modern civilization in terms of technology rather than in terms of energy, and not seeing that actually the technologies that have changed the world have had energy sources to them. So I think that there's some sense in which we haven't actually collectively understood the, if you like, the material conditions of our existence in the modern world very well. But at the same time, having said that, and this is a kind of like caveat to that point in some respects, is that I think if we were having this conversation in the 1970s, then I don't think anybody in Western countries would have turned around and said, oh, we're not taking energy very seriously. I mean, I was a child in the 1970s.
Me too.
And I had an understanding that energy was pretty important.
Absolutely.
If you sat around in the darkness in the evenings because of power cuts and coal strikes in the case of Britain, you did understand it. And I think that what we need in some sense to explain is how a certain kind of perhaps amnesia about that decade and what it meant sort of set in. And I think it's an interesting question, when did it do so, whether it was the latter part of the 80s or we needed to go into the 1990s. But anyway, I think that there's a kind of interlude. And the interesting thing about the interlude is that it doesn't really end, I think, even when it's very obvious in the mid-2000s that oil is become a real issue on the back of what's essentially stagnant production outside Russia and on the back of this sharp rise in Chinese demand.
Yes.
So I think in some sense we could have all come to energy consciousness, if that's what it is.
Yes, yes.
In those years running up to 2008, you know, at the point in which at peak, you know, oil prices hit $150 a barrel. But then the whole 2008 narrative became overwhelmed by the financial crash,
Absolutely. In
some sense, for understandable reasons. And I think that energy as part of, which I think is part of that, what happened in 2007-8 was kind of forgotten about. And the next interlude is really brought about by shale oil and shale gas, which sort of, in some sense, particularly on the oil side, compensate for the problems that were there by the middle of the 2000s. And our latest round of energy wake-up, I would say, probably began last autumn.
Yes.
As prices across not just oil and gas but coal, which was actually quite striking, I was quite taken aback by it in some sense, started to rise as much as they did. Now you could say that then, you know, Omicron came along and we started worrying about the COVID again and not about energy. But I think that any time we get into a period where there's recovery from COVID, economic recovery from COVID, we're going to be thinking about energy. So I think that we're not going back to not taking it seriously.
We're not going back, and we're probably also kind of going forward to a new energy era, with energy as a kind of, as you described, green energy as the second source of geopolitical instability, running concurrently with that generated by fossil fuel energy. And that actually particularly exposes a fault line between the US, United States, and China. As you write, a specter haunting Washington is that without a decisive American strategic turn to renewables and electrification, the new energy age will belong to China. And do you see, I mean, we're obviously all very focused on Ukraine and Russia at the moment, but do you see energy and green energy and renewable energy as, you know, something that is ultimately at the core of the United States-China schism, geopolitical schism? And what are, you know, as you see it now, the geopolitical implications of that shift to green energy? You know, are China and the US on a collision course over green energy, and how might that play out in the years ahead?
Yeah, I mean, this is in some sense another sort of tricky, complicated question, because if you want to ask, well, what is absolutely at the core of the geopolitical rivalry now that exists between the United States and China, I'm not sure how far I would want to say that green energy is the primary fault line there. I think energy generally is pretty important in understanding what has gone on. I think that what we can say is, if we say that things changed in the US-China relationship in some sense on both sides, I think the watershed moment is actually, it's not Trump's arrival, you know, in the Oval Office. I think it's Made in China 2025, which was published in 2015, and green energy and dominance of the supply chains around green energy,
yes,
at least of course rare earth minerals,
yes,
is a pretty important part of Made in China 2025. And I think it does frighten people in Washington. I think it's actually Made in China 2025 that turns the US-China economic relationship on the American side, I mean here, really strongly in a geopolitical direction. And in that sense, Trump is actually, despite the intemperate way in which he expressed things, expressing actually what is has become a broad consensus position. It's probably the only thing in which Trump articulated that there's a broad consensus position in American
and a bipartisan position on it. You know, it's one of the few issues that is subject to
absolutely
bipartisanship still in a very polarized U.S. political environment. Is the position on China?
And you can say, I think that if you say, okay, well, what's at the heart of that? If you then look at the Trump presidency itself and the trade war with China, well, solar panels was one of the first two products in which tariffs was put on. I think refrigerators was the other one, but I could be wrong about it. There's other refrigerators or washing machines. And then at a certain point, it's quite late in his presidency, but he's engaged in quite a lot of rhetoric about it. Before then, he issues an executive order declaring a national emergency on minerals, rare earth minerals in particular, in which it's very clear that people in Washington, and not just Trump again, think that there's a massive problem with the dependency of the United States on rare earth minerals from China. And the point of the national emergency is to create, resurrect domestic production in these areas. Biden then issued an executive order quite quickly. It was cast more generally and perhaps in less anti-Chinese terms than the way in which I think it was presented by Trump, but it was basically in the same area. So I don't really see that there's been any difference, any departure in Biden's presidency in this respect. And I think the fear is that metals are fundamental to the green energy transition, that China is an extremely dominant position in the both possession of them and the production, extractive production of them, and that China not only can use them as a geopolitical weapon, but has used them as a geopolitical weapon against Japan. Back in 2010, there was an export ban after a dispute about fishing trawlers. And that there's an understanding in Beijing that they should, in some sense, be used as a geopolitical weapon. That in the same sense in which, from their point of view, that they've got an energy security problem because of their dependency on the the Middle East and the ability of the American Navy in the final instance to essentially be able to blockade exports from the Persian Gulf to China, that this is their strength. And I think that the two things are going to exist. The geopolitics of fossil fuel energy and the geopolitics of green energy are going to exist simultaneously with each other in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the striking things about the book is, you know, it has energy as a theme running through it, but it also has the fact that really nearly all of the schisms we have seen play out in recent years have their kind of origins, you know, political, economic, democratic schisms have their origins in the 1970s and changes that occurred in the world economy and in politics in the 1970s, which has generally been told as a story of kind of an ideological shift that happened with the advent of, you know, Thatcher and Reagan and neoliberalism and the rejection of the kind of post-war consensus in the aftermath of the oil shock of the 70s. But you actually argue that it is kind of something different. The story is somewhat different. And you particularly talk about the manner in which the openness to international capital flows magnified what you call the aristocratic features of democracies, which ultimately meant that taxing the middle class became easier than taxing the rich. And despite that, the parties of the centre, whether it's the centre-right or the centre-left, the lesson they took from the 70s and 80s was that actually democratic excess manifested in inflation was a greater hazard than aristocratic excess manifested in the rich not paying very high taxes. I'm wondering, given everything we've seen in recent years and the changes we've seen, whether it's Brexit, Trump, populism, do you think that the reverse is now true? Do you think that the lesson that the parties of the centre have learned now is that aristocratic excess is actually the greater danger to democracies? And if that lesson has been learned, or if that light bulb has gone off, how do you think democracies will confront this?
I think that the lesson has certainly partly been learned. And I think that there's a sense in which one might interpret the reaction in the United Kingdom to Brexit by the governing party, the Conservatives, and the reaction of the Democrats under Biden to the Trump presidency, of saying that at least in economic policy areas, we need to do something that is quite different. I mean, that in some sense, I think, is how to understand the leveling up agenda of the Johnson government, of saying that democratic politics in the United Kingdom has to produce economic outcomes, at least, that are more advantageous to those who look like they were left behind by the changes in economies, Western economies, since the 1970s, and in the United States, that the Biden administration, you know, threw, you know, fiscal caution to the wind when it came in and said that what we need is big infrastructure projects. We need to recreate the national manufacturing, a national manufacturing sector in the United States, and indeed wanted to use green energy as really the basis, I think, of that. And I actually think you could see the green energy thing on the UK side is supposed to work in the same kind of way, that in some sense is that this can be turned into an economic opportunity that leaves behind some of the problems of aristocratic excess, to use my language, democratic politics that prevailed prior to 2016. I think there are other aspects of it that are more difficult, not least the taxation issue itself. I think you can see some of that in what happened in France. Macron, in a way, I think, wanted to use the language of democratic renewal, both in the way in which he campaigned for the presidency, the way in which he's been quite keen on citizen assemblies, the way in which he responded to the Gilets Jaunes movement. But he was also pretty clear that more taxes on the rich wasn't going to be part of
it. Absolutely. No, he didn't.
He was very explicit that wasn't going to be happening when he was doing his great listening exercise. So that was ruled out from the start. And I think in the United States, where the influence of corporations, and not least through campaign donations and lobbying, I don't think that there's been any kind of decisive shift away from the politics around that in Biden's Democratic Party. There would have been if someone like Sanders had won the Democratic nomination, but he didn't. So I think that there's greater awareness. There's some sense in which certain kinds of policy areas, particularly in the ways in which green energy and manufacturing sectors are being thought about, is definitely responsive and saying, look, we can't go, we do have to address this, we can't go back. But there's other areas, starting, I think, with taxation, but not confined to taxation, that is going to be much harder, even for politicians who want to take the lessons of what has happened over the last 20 years to address.
Yeah, I mean, we see that, you're absolutely right, we see that playing out in the Democratic coalition, where you have wealthy donors, preventing any discussion around tax increases, while at the same time you have an attempt by the administration to, you know, change the economic settlement somewhat for, you know, in the ways that you described. I mean, we also see it playing out in the UK with the extent to which, you know, London is a kind of a destination for, you know, international capital and international wealth to kind of park its wealth and to kind of, you know, to devise structures and schemes that allow it to do that. And you see some of that, I think, playing out with the potential response to Russia's incursion in Ukraine.
Absolutely.
Where the Johnson government is saying that we will crack down on this kind of thing. But the actual kind of political economy of that is very difficult, because, you know, the entire London high-end property sector, restaurants, PR firms, you know, there's an entire economic ecosystem that is based off that, welcoming environment for, you know, the international elite and wealth. And it's very difficult to see how you turn that around and how you change that.
I think it's very difficult to see how it turns around outside some kind of collapse scenario, which is obviously deeply unattractive to any set of politicians in power. It can be chip away at the edges, but as you say, there's such an ecosystem around it in London, in particular.
In Dublin, in Dublin too, actually. It's something we have as well in our
radical action. It's just not going to happen.
The pandemic at one stage looked like it might be that that collapse or that radical action. I mean, I'm very struck in the book that, you know, you say that it's been war, not elections and full franchises, that has proved the necessary conditions for tax systems that levy high taxes on the rich, as well as increasing the share of income going to labour. You see war really as the kind of the thing that has shifted the needle, so to speak. And I think there was a time during the pandemic when it looked like that might be the case. I'm not so sure now, and I just wonder how do you think the pandemic or the post-pandemic era will play out, how the pandemic plays into that, and do you think it is part of the story here of changing that kind of aristocratic excess that has been the kind of leitmotif of you know, advanced economies since the 1970s? Do you think that it plays into this story?
I do. I mean, I think that there is ways in which it looked for a while, perhaps even sort of last summer, early autumn, where the fact that, in some sense, the shock to the labour market that had occurred as a result of the pandemic looked like they might be strengthening Labour's, if you like, bargaining power. That might still play out, but I think that it would be foolish for anybody to start worrying about that being particularly inflationary, because although it might play out at a micro level in certain sectors where we've seen a significant exit of people, trade unions just are nowhere near as powerful as that they were in the 1970s. So, in principle, I think that it looked like some change might be possible. I wouldn't say that it would have been inevitable. I think what's clearly the case, though, at the same time, and these are not contradictory things, they're just things that are happening parallel is that some of the dynamics that we saw, that I was using the term aristocratic excess to capture, were just reinforced by the pandemic.
Absolutely.
I mean, look at the, you know, how the world's, you know, richest billionaires became even more expensive, sorry, even more richer, even richer, I should say, during the pandemic. If you look at the role that quantitative easing has played in this, and the value of assets and the part that inflation has played in wealth inequality, then for very understandable reasons, faced with complete financial meltdown in March 2020, the Fed and other central banks had to move to, you know, what in the US terms might be called QE infinity.
Yes.
And the consequences of that, obviously, just if you like, Uber power, the dynamics where those with who own shares and then everything that goes with that have even more wealth than they did before. And you can't actually think about changing that without risking the kind of financial meltdown that for the middle of March 2020, in the middle of March 2020, was occurring, which I think at its peak was actually, you know, the, in some sense, was the 2008 financial crisis on steroids.
It could have been, yeah. I mean, it could have played out in that way. I mean, there was a very famous, I think, intervention in that week, early March 2020, by Christine Lagarde, president of the ECB, where she said it wasn't her job or the ECB's job to tighten the spreads in bond yields between various Eurozone member states. And I think there was a moment of danger, and Adam Tooze has obviously written about this very persuasively, at that time when things could have really, you know, really, really gone in a very dangerous direction, or in a very bad direction, you know, akin to 2008. And then they pulled it back. And I had a bit part in that. I kind of worked in the Department of Finance in Ireland at that time. And I could see, we could see that. But something changed, and the lessons kind of were learned at that time. But I suppose the question is, were the lessons learned in a sense of crisis response, or were there longer term implications? If you look at the way in which the EU in particular dealt with those two crises, the 2008 financial crisis, where the response was, you know, austerity and deflation, and then you look at the way it dealt with the COVID crisis in the spring of 2020 and onwards, where it led to the EU recovery fund and joint borrowing for the first time. Are there longer term implications for that? Is that something where you see that shift going on, and it may be somewhat imperceptible at the time, but actually, long term, it does lead to a different type of, eurozone architecture that is just fundamentally different to what went before.
I think that the if we look at it in terms of the eurozone at that moment, I think that the eurozone did make a pretty consequential shift in terms of the response in the spring of 2020. It came, as you say, after the moment when it all looked like it was falling apart, after Lagarde's remarks. But I think if you look at that moment in March 2020, I think I say this at one point in the book, it's like it's the 2007-08 financial crisis from the American point of view, the Eurozone crisis from the Eurozone's point of view, and the China's financial crisis in 2015-16 all rolled into one.
Yes, yeah.
They all do things much more quickly than they did dealing with those crises. And the one that's obviously where it's so much speedier, the response that ends the crisis moment, is the European Central Bank case, because we get pandemic, QE before actually the Bank of England introduces a new QE program, whereas there was a 6-year difference, or nearly a 6-year difference,
absolutely,
between the Bank of England first time round and the European Central Bank. So that's a really radical change. Then, as you say, Ed, there's the recovery fund. Now, I think that is a pretty consequential shift. Because for the first time you have the idea of common eurozone debt. I think that the difficulty for the EU here, for the eurozone here, is that the way in which the recovery fund was institutionally set up, it seems quite a bit of it at Merkel's insistence, sort of bounds sorry, ties up the Eurozone question, the question of Eurozone debt, with the wider European Union.
Absolutely.
Which includes non-Euro members. Mm-hmm. And then you got the ability of, like, Poland and Hungary mm-hmm. to play hardball about other issues that are nothing to do with Eurozone debt, that you need Polish and Hungarian consent to it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some parallels there with the way in which that in the Eurozone crisis, that the issue of, like, what to do with Britain as a non-Eurozone member in the EU mm-hmm. got tangled up with the Eurozone crisis. Mm-hmm. And then this time around, it was more on the, well, how do Poland and Hungary fit into this? So I think that you can see a potential path forward, in principle at least, of the Eurozone moving towards greater, or not, some more fiscal union mm-hmm. common debt that isn't just for the purposes of recovery from the mm-hmm. pandemic, but it has to resolve the ins and outs question of monetary union in relation to the EU's institutional structures.
Yes, I guess what is different about the position of Hungary and Poland is that the EU has some kind of means of enforcement there with them in terms of the rule of law, and there was an ECJ judgment recently which kind of brought that out, and really this is a huge struggle between the Commission and Poland and Germany, but it does seem to have some tools in its armory which I guess it was lacking when it came to Britain. And I might come back to the EU fiscal question in a minute, but I was very struck by your treatment in the book on the links between the Eurozone crisis and Brexit. And I think, you know, coming from Ireland, it is not perhaps an aspect of it that we've considered particularly. I mean, there have been much Irish writing on Brexit and its sources. People like Fintan O'Toole have written about it, and it is generally a story of, you know, Britain never really sitting easily within the EU, and this being something that then became weaponized through the politics of the Tory party and political opportunism on the side of the likes of Farage. But you actually write that the Eurozone crisis set in motion the path that led Britain out of the EU. And the reason you say that happened is because Britain had effectively become, during that crisis, along with Germany, what you call an employer of last resort for the Eurozone. The consequence of this was that it meant that the Conservative Lib Dem coalition government at the time was never going to achieve its immigration targets. Now, certain people have taken issue with this characterization of those events. Howard Davis, in a review of Disorder, argued really that in the time after 2011, 5 years after 2011, really the number of Italians, Spaniards and Greeks in the UK really rose by kind of tiny dimensions. These would have been the countries most on the front lines of the Eurozone crisis and with the labour market shocks. So he thinks that's a stretch to link it. But I am interested in this link between Britain's exit from the EU and the politics of the Eurozone. What it might tell us about those fault lines.
Well, as you know, Ed, I have in some sense, three Brexit stories. Mm. I have one in the geopolitics, mm-hmm. which I would say isn't actually causal. Mm. So I should say the geopolitics part of the book, which isn't actually causal. It's about the relationship between the sequence of events about Brexit and the sequence of geopolitical events, including the spillover of what's gone on in Syria via the migrant crisis. Mm. And then I have the economic story, which is, as you say, about the Eurozone crisis, and then I have a story about the issues of constitutionally legitimating treaties in Britain, which is really about the Lisbon Treaty and the democratic politics part. And so I think that there are two big causal stories, and one sort of setting, the geopolitics is setting. Now, if we take the Eurozone crisis in its own terms for a moment, my story, I think, here is twofold. The first of them is actually nothing to do with the freedom of movement and migration from Southern Europe into the European Union. Mm. It's about the way in which the Eurozone crisis politicised the United Kingdom's position as being simultaneously outside monetary union and having in London the financial centre of the Eurozone.
Yes.
And I think that demarcated the United Kingdom from the other non-Eurozone members at the moment in which the Eurozone crisis began. And if you look at the period from when the coalition government led by David Cameron came into power through to January 2013, which is when Cameron made his Bloomberg speech
yes.
and made the first promise renegotiations
and an in-out
referendum, mm-hmm. then pretty much everything that Cameron was both doing and saying mm. is bound up with the first of those questions, the question of the London's position as a financial centre while the United Kingdom is not in monetary union. And mm. it's very little to do, if anything, to do with the migration issue. And I think the crucial juncture there is actually what happens in the December 2011 Brussels summit, mm-hmm. where Cameron goes with the idea that he can veto the fiscal, what is going to become the fiscal treaty, mm-hmm. unless that various protections are given to British financial services mm. that will stop a majority of Eurozone countries essentially imposing rules on for regulation that the British government doesn't agree with. And it's already by this point pursuing a case in the European Court of Justice trying to uphold a principle of non-discrimination against non-Eurozone members. It really goes horribly wrong for Cameron at that summit. He mm-hmm. finds that actually he doesn't have the negotiating power that he thinks that he had. And it's after that that he starts seriously thinking, and he discusses this in his memoirs, about holding an in-out referendum. Mm. And he actually writes a newspaper article, I think it's in about June of 2012, where he essentially says, unless we can find a way of dealing with protecting British interests as a non-Eurozone member, now that the EU is having to deal with the Eurozone crisis, we're on a path out of the European Union. Mm. And I think what then happens is that as 2012 goes on, we begin to see a British economic recovery mm. at the same time as the Eurozone economy collectively is gone back into recession, and some individual Eurozone economies are quite deep in recession.
It's also that period is also the time when Draghi makes his famous whatever it takes speech, July 2012. Yeah,
July 2012. Yeah. But I think that the crucial divergence has actually happened pre Draghi. Mm-hmm. If Draghi had come in earlier, I think things might have actually turned out differently. In this respect, because the crucial divergence has happened in 2011, mm. When you get quite a surge in inflation that mm-hmm. comes from oil prices going back over $100 a barrel. Mm-hmm. You have quite high inflation. Actually, you have higher inflation in Britain than you do in a number of the Eurozone countries. And whilst the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England do not respond to that rise in inflation driven by oil prices,
Trichet does.
Yeah. It puts interest rates up twice.
Yes.
In 2011, yes. And until that point, it's pretty clear that mm-hmm. the British economic recovery post 2008 is less successful than mm-hmm. the French or the German. And then things change, mm-hmm. And what you see is a macroeconomic divergence. And as that macroeconomic divergence begins to play out, British growth is coming back, the Eurozone is in recession, that is when you see this uptake in migration from Southern Europe into Southern European EU countries into the United Kingdom, a pattern that had not been there before, because most of the migration previously to that had been from East European
yes.
countries, the A8 accession. And that migration, if you look at the timing of the increases, it basically parallels quite tightly the rise of UKIP in the opinion polls. Mm. By the time we then get into 2013, after Cameron's made his Bloomberg speech, we're looking at the UKIP making a lot of Conservative MPs, or some Conservative MPs, quite fearful. Mm-hmm. We have the by-elections in which UKIP wins from the Conservative MPs who defect. And having made his referendum promise, and including in that a renegotiation promise, which I think is really consequential to the story.
Yeah.
Cameron is then in the position where, instead of doing the renegotiating just about trying to find what he sees as the necessary for protection for Britain and London's position in particular as mm-hmm. a non-Euro member, he has got to try and win some concessions on the migration issue, and they're not
yes.
forthcoming. And
yes.
in part, the reason I think they're not forthcoming is because Britain is largely irrelevant to the Eurozone issues that are very understandably preoccupying the major EU states at the time, not least obviously the German government.
Yeah.
So I can see why someone might, calling it employer of last resort is a bit of a quip.
Mm.
I can see why somebody might object to the quip.
Mm.
But I think it's pretty hard to argue against the idea that the Eurozone crisis has had the destabilizing impact that it
yes.
did.
Yeah.
On the politics of Britain's membership. And if you listen to, or if you read the speech that Ivan Rogers, who was the UK's former ambassador to
yes.
the European Union, gave, I think he gave it in the latter part of 2017, I mean, his argument's pretty similar to mine. I mean, I don't follow it exactly because I'd already written an article that argued this before Ivan Rogers gave his speech, but he was at the heart of what was going on.
He was.
And he saw, and he said, he's got this bit where he actually says, I keep talking to people in other European countries and they don't understand why the Eurozone crisis is destabilising
yeah.
British politics.
Yeah, yeah.
And no, he says, well, look, it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it is just such an interesting point because it is something that is kind of absent from the debate. And actually, I think the kind of moment in Ireland, certainly, when we looked at how Cameron was playing it and thought that, you know, there was a real danger ahead, was when he put so much into renegotiation, because I think it was clear to us from the very beginning that, you know, the kind of renegotiation that he anticipated was just not going to happen, and it couldn't happen. And look, there were many reasons for that. But when he had put all his kind of eggs in the renegotiation basket, we felt there was just real significant risk, and that was the kind of real wake up call for us in the kind of 2014 15 period.
I mean, Cameron would have been much better off just calling a referendum than he would having renegotiations.
Absolutely, the renegotiation set the referendum up to fail in many ways, because it gave the kind of vote leave really their main argument their strongest argument against EU membership. I mean, the Eurozone, you know, is obviously a subject very close to my own heart and something I look at quite closely. And I'm struck by your discussion of the EU's exit and the UK's EU exit and this issue of, the constitutionalization of economic policy that happens through the Eurozone and the kind of, how that then plays across with what Luke van Middelaar would call, the Dutch writer would call, you know, events politics, and contrast that with rules politics, which is the kind of constitutionalization of economic policy that happens in the Eurozone. And the story of the last number of years between the EU and the UK as one of the clash between those rules politics and those events politics, and the response of the EU to the pandemic being a sense of events politics prevailing for the time being. As part of that, you were very critical of the ECB's role in this story, and in particular the manner in which the Maastricht Treaty kind of entrenched a kind of monetary economic distinction within the EU and later in the Eurozone, where you write the monetary realm was supranational and technocratic, and the rest of economic policy is national and democratic. And you believe that distinction has entirely broken down within the Eurozone. I mean, just to come back to this issue of the Eurozone, if it is by kind of events politics and crisis that the Eurozone proceeds, and yet the Eurozone is embedded in these rules and this distinction between monetary and economic policy, Is it ultimately viable? I mean, does there have to be some moment when, you know, these distinctions will have to be tackled? And if they are tackled, how do you tackle them? How do you have a monetary policy that is returned more to the political realm without creating enormous political schisms and difficulties within the Eurozone?
Well, I think in some ways that is what you described is actually the breakdown of this, is how to characterize what happened as the European Central Bank's response to the Eurozone crisis, so that the rules didn't, not only did the rules not apply, the rules couldn't apply. That if everything had been done by the book of the Maastricht Treaty, then the Eurozone, Draghi would never have been able to take the ECB out. So Draghi would never have been able to take the Eurozone out of crisis, and that it had to be improvised in an emergency. It took as long as it did because tacit German consent had to be given to the change that took place. So I'd say that this European Central Bank isn't anything like the European Central Bank that was created by the Maastricht Treaty. And in one sense, I think that that just the European Union, the Eurozone, just lives with that. I think the difficulty, where things get more difficult, is when you look at this in political terms. So moving away from it as an economic question, and you look at it into as well, what are the consequences of this for the democratic politics of those member states that are most reliant on the European Central Bank to support their debt? And I think here, actually, the really striking case and really interesting case is what's happened in Italy.
Yes.
Because I think we can see pretty clearly, right the way going back to the autumn of 2011, and the role that the European Central Bank played in the end of Silvio Berlusconi's government, through to the fact that Mario Draghi himself is now the Prime Minister of Italy, that Italy's democratic politics has become incredibly bound up with essentially the matter of who the ECB will approve of sufficiently being in government and taking decisions such that it can support Italy's debt. And so actually it's become really difficult in Italy for elections to determine who exercises power. So although the last election produced, as we know, in 2018, April, I think it was April 2018, produced in the end the governing coalition between Five Star and
the Lega.
We've been through several different iterations of an Italian government since then. And what started off as the two labelled populist Eurosceptic parties have given way before another election has taken place to one, a third of which the cabinet are technocrats and headed by the former former president of the European Central Bank. So I think that is actually now where the really awkward political questions are actually for Eurozone members. And it doesn't apply in all Eurozone countries because obviously it's not the case. What's happened in Italy, you know, it hasn't happened in Ireland, it hasn't happened in
Spain,
Spain, Germany, but it has pretty consequentially happened in Italy.
And Greece as well, I guess you could say, in a way.
I mean, definitely. I mean, I think that, you know, there's obviously a parallel between the removal of Berlusconi from power that autumn and the removal of Papandreou from power in Greece that autumn in 2011 as well.
And Syriza's fateful move to in 2015 after the referendum to actually throw the towel in and just say, look, you know, we voted for one thing, but you know, we're going to do something completely different because the ECB demands it.
I think that the Syriza story is pretty important because in terms of the way that we think about the EU more generally, I think a lot of the narrative at the time, people who were being critical got taken up with Varoufakis's own sort of the imposition of his narrative onto it, which was sort of he, you know, had the will, extension, strength of mind, etc., to stand up to the Troika and the ECB, and he was let back down by Tsipras, his prime minister, etc. But actually, what was always at issue wasn't whether Greece could set an example of defaulting on its debt; it was whether Greece was going to get expelled from the Eurozone.
Absolutely.
That was what the issue was. And the European Central Bank played its part along the way with Wolfgang Schäuble of setting up that possibility. Mm-hmm. Indeed, I would say for a while it was probability that Greece was going to be expelled. Now, in one sense, you can say, okay, that's emergency politics. That's the EU needing to, or the Eurozone in this case, needing to move out of a rule-based order. But it's a very striking kind of emergency politics that is really at odds with a lot of the things that we think about democratic politics and what the place of central banks should be in it.
Absolutely, and I mean, I think the Greek thing has almost been forgotten in recent years. But I suppose the message it sends to, you know, any government that would wish to come to power and change economic policy within a Eurozone member state is that there are absolute limits to your freedom of action and your agency around changes to economic policy that you may wish to, implement, irrespective of, you know, the democratic mandate for them. And I think I often think of this in the context of Sinn Féin in Ireland, who you know, are very rising in the polls, and, you know, there's a fair chance they will lead the next Irish government, and would have traditionally been deeply Eurosceptical, and, you know, would have, you know, opposed the fiscal treaty and various other Eurozone policies and moves. And yet, I think when they do come to power, they will be faced with exactly the same reality that Syriza faced, or that Papandreou faced, or that, you know, Italian governments face, that there are, you know, very, very clear constraints to the freedom of action of governments to pursue their own path or economic policy. And I think ultimately, I just wonder how sustainable that is, in the long run, absent, you know, some rupture.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you go back to the 80s, and obviously Mitterrand's government is in some sense Exhibit A here, there's clearly a history of governments that come into power wanting to do quite radical, or even in Mitterrand's case, probably moderately radical things in economic policy, and then they get bashed around in the government get the currencies, I should say, get bashed around in the foreign exchange markets, and then they have to decide what to do about it. And, you know, Mitterrand, you know, March 1983, when he reached his moment of decision, ultimately decided that he was going to keep France in the exchange rate mechanism. He was going to pursue the Frankfurt, the strong franc policy, and basically try to imitate German macroeconomic policy. So it's not the case, I think, that there's something entirely new about governments coming in with moderately to strongly radical intentions and finding themselves constrained in office and finding they have to do something that's pretty much the exact opposite than what they came in to office promising to do. And you might say that that had some implications for democratic politics too. I think the difference in terms of what happened in the Eurozone cases in the Italy and Greece, and to some extent I would say, though it played out differently, Spain also in 2011, is when you so clearly have the European Central Bank, or in this case it's just the central bank, let's just say, playing its part in not only the governments in question being constrained, but actually their terms in office being ended in the case of Berlusconi and Papandreou.
Yes.
And then later in the 2015 crisis, essentially a member state being threatened with expulsion from the Eurozone. I think that whilst you can kind of absorb into democratic politics more readily the governments get constrained by the financial markets and then they adjust what they do, when you have these more sort of conspicuous removals from power, or in Italy's case just the persistent now inability for there to be elected prime ministers or elected finance ministers, then I think that perhaps it takes a deeper toll. I still think it's a bit early perhaps to see where this story ends, but I think the place where it's going to sort of play out to its conclusion is in Italy.
And in their defence, I think the ECB would say that they have, you know, they have had to act because, you know, the fiscal authorities have not acted, and they've often been left holding the can, really, for the failures of the fiscal authorities. In fact, Draghi's final speech in 2019 explicitly states this, and I think, you know, the current leadership of the ECB would say the same. It really is up to Europe's, you know, governments and politicians to get their act together on fiscal policy and have a more coherent, you know, collective fiscal policy. And if that were the case, the ECB would, you know, would relinquish, you know, some of its role in this drama. And I think that is the key schism, really, that is there at the moment. I think that is where, you know, the action needs to be. But at the same time, I don't see any real sense, even with, you know, a new German government and, you know, Draghi in Italy and perhaps Macron coming back and, you know, perhaps an ambition, greater ambition for greater fiscal integration. I still don't see the steps towards that or the path towards that very clearly. And I think in the absence of that, you will continue to see the ECB being, you know, the kind of player of last resort, to kind of adapt your phrase, in European macroeconomic policy. And I think that is the issue. I don't think the ECB has ambitions to play that role, but I think it has been left in a situation where it has no choice because of the failures of politics.
Yeah, I mean, I should say, I agree with that entirely. If you go back to, I think it was 2012 that Trichet gave a really interesting speech after he left, in which he explicitly revisits the question of what happened in the autumn of 2011 and the end of the Berlusconi government. And he clearly regards it as pretty problematic, pretty deeply problematic, what has happened. And he's kind of like looking to find a way, in some sense, I would say, of finding some democratic or political, at least political, authorization for the ECB acting in that emergency moment, because I think he understands perfectly well that actually that the ECB can't get in the habit of doing this.
Yeah.
Because it will be, you know, entirely destructive of its monetary authority in the end if it does so. But as you say, without actually finding a way of having Eurozone common fiscal capacity, it's pretty difficult to see what the way out is.
Yep.
Because if you just go back to Italy, then Italy clearly is not going to increase its fiscal capacity entirely of its own, on its own.
Absolutely not.
Able to.
No. The solution has to come in some form of, you know, collective European fiscal capacity. But we've been waiting a long time for that, and I'm just not sure if we're there yet. Helen, at the end of the book, at the end of this order, you conclude with a somewhat gloomy but maybe realistic assessment of the energy transition, where you really say that it will be more likely that it will be a long energy transition than a rapid one. And to mitigate against the possibility of the destructive politics that could come because of that, collective understanding needs to catch up with the conjunction of physical realities about energy and the realities of climate change entails. Careening between the ideas of a technologically driven salvation and an inescapable Götterdämmerung is a hopeless response. I mean, I'm very struck by this because I think there is a kind of a mismatch between the, I guess, you know, utopian visions around, you know, renewable energy and a kind of zero world that we hear a lot these days, and then also the kind of, you know, abandon all hope, you know, end of the world, extinction rebellion, you know, rhetoric that we hear, and I absolutely agree that there has to be some kind of realistic politics around the energy transition. The problem is I don't really see it anywhere in democratic settings, in democratic states. And where I do see it is in China, to be entirely honest. I mean, I think there is a kind of a politics of climate realism that is at the core of the Chinese Communist Party now, and in terms of their actions, not just their rhetoric. Is this the case that there is a greater prospect for that kind of climate realism or realism around energy transition in an authoritarian state like China than in the democratic world, or is China kind of sui generis? You can't kind of extrapolate from China, given that what a unique entity it kind of is, to a broader assessment of the advantages of authoritarianism over democracy in this energy transition that we're facing.
I certainly agree with you, Ed, that there's a greater energy and climate realism, I think, in China, at least in the discourse that comes out of China anyway, and then it's backed by some of China's actions, than we often see in Western democracies. I suspect that there's actually a greater understanding in governments of energy realism, energy and climate realism, than is sometimes expressed, shall we say. And I think a good example of that is the speech that Angela Merkel, a speech I should say, that Angela Merkel gave at the beginning of 2020 that got rather overwhelmed, obviously, by the pandemic, where I think she laid out the challenges ahead in very realistic terms. So I'm not, though, convinced, really, I think, though, like you, I spent some time thinking about this, that China's distinct approach here, or what looks like China's distinct approach, is really the product of China's authoritarianism, and that the disadvantage is democracy. I think that what is the case is that there's still a much stronger faith in modernity in China. And so if, which I think it is that the energy is the dark underbelly of modernity, so to speak, then the place where modernity is still taken as incredibly seriously as it is in China as a project is a place where, in some sense, you would then expect to see the clearest thinking about energy. So I think that what you don't get in China, and this is the good thing, is you get much less of this binary, it's either utopia or it's got a Dameron stuff that we, in some sense, have to put up with in Western democratic politics. Is that they don't see, I think, as anything incompatible with being very serious about the predicaments we face around fossil fuel energy, at the same time as being very serious about climate change and consequently trying to move away from fossil fuel energy. They, to adapt a bit of Adam Tooze's language for slightly different purposes, kind of, I think of it as a polycrisis of energy and try to deal with it across the whole. And I think there's less evidence that that's what's going on. That's what's going on here. I think, though, that if we think about the energy revolution, transition, whatever we're calling it, as being something that is going to cause very considerable distributional conflict, then I still think that democracies are better at dealing with these deep conflicts of interest than authoritarian states are. Not because it's particularly pretty what happens in democratic politics, but it allows the possibility of governments that are getting it very badly wrong, being removed from power peacefully, and it allows an open contest about how to deal with the conflicts of interest at stake around energy consumption in a way that is going to be very difficult for those open conflicts to happen. Necessary conflicts, I should say. Necessary contest, perhaps would be the way to put it. Necessary contest about the conflicts of interest. So I'm less convinced that China has advantages in dealing with the distributional politics of energy consumption over the next few decades.
A Chinese fate in modernity versus the Western, contestation of distributional politics of energy. It will be something to watch in the years and decades ahead. Helen, thank you very much for the wonderful conversation.
That's great. Thank you.
It's a book everyone really should read. It gets to the core of the kind of crises that we've experienced in the recent years, and draws real connections between things that you may not make connections with, and goes to the root of things. So please, everyone, buy this order, and it's an essential read. Thank you, Helen.
Thanks, Ed. Pleasure.
You've been listening to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.